then, counsel. Ready to proceed? Welcome back, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Jack Phillips. I represent E.I. DuPont, Dina Moores and Company. However, I'm addressing the court on behalf of all six of the landowner defendants. Mr. Albert Manwaring, counsel for Honeywell, will also address the court on behalf of issues specific to Honeywell and some general matters that might be of interest to the court. Your Honors, the question presented here today is a very specific one. And that question is whether a contractor's employee who is injured by the work of another contractor on the work site has a cause of action against the landowner arising from the hazard that the other contractor created. The answer to that question is that absent control by the landowner over the contractor that created the hazard, there is no cause of action against the landowner. Section 343 does not make the landowner indirectly liable for the negligence or the hazard caused by his contractor if the landowner did not exercise control over that contractor. The trial court found, and there has been no appeal from that finding, that the landowners here did not exercise control over the plaintiff's work or over the work that caused the hazard. The key fact at issue is that the hazard was created by an independent contractor performing work contemporaneously with or after plaintiff's entry onto the premises.
Can I stop you right there? You're defining the hazard as being the asbestos dust getting into the air?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it equally appropriate if one chooses to define that hazard as the asbestos which was in the property?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the asbestos on the property left undisturbed is not hazardous. It can sit there for years and not cause any problem whatsoever. It is only when it is worked with improperly that it becomes a hazard. It's much like electricity, Your Honor. Electricity can be a hazard if improperly disturbed, but you know, electrical outlets and electrical panel, they're fine as long as they're worked with properly or as long as they're not improperly disturbed. It's the same with the asbestos. The asbestos sitting there is not a latent defect. The asbestos is perfectly fine by itself.
Is that a factual finding or a legal conclusion or what?
That's something that has been, I believe, accepted in the tort law of Delaware since the beginning of the asbestos litigation. There's no ruling saying that it's a latent defect, Your Honor. There's no ruling saying that
I didn't say it's a latent defect. You said that there was no hazard. And I asked whether the asbestos itself is a hazardous material. And you're saying, no, it's not a hazardous material, that it's only when it's exposed or improperly used.
Disturbed,
fine.
No.
And what I'm asking is, I understand that's your position. Is that something that has been established as a matter of fact, or is that something that is recognized as a matter of law, or what?
Well, I would say it's recognized as a matter of law because it's never been ruled to the contrary. As we discussed the last time we were here, Your Honor, the asbestos in place in our schools was started to be removed, and then everybody realized that this is unnecessary. It makes matters worse doing that. So it's been left in place. Implicit in that is a finding that in place, undisturbed, is not hazardous. It's not until it is improperly disturbed that it becomes hazardous. And if properly worked with, it is not hazardous. During the course of the last argument, Mr. Lilly itemized for this court a number of things that could be done in order to avoid the release of asbestos dust and avoid exposure to asbestos dust. He specifically enumerated that you could barricade off the area. At another point in time, he said you could put up a barrier, which I took to mean you could drape off the room. He said you could wet down the material. He said you could wrap the material. And he also said, and there were other things that could be done. But all of that indicates that it can be worked with, and worked with without creating a hazard, and if worked with properly, is not hazardous, which then leads to the conclusion that it's not an ultra-hazardous activity. And of course, the very premise of Mr. Lilly's entire argument last time was two erroneous assumptions. That is, the mere presence of it is a latent defect, and working with it is always ultra-hazardous. But he's undermined those positions by virtue of his acknowledgement to this court last time. So the key point here, Your Honor, is that these landowners have ceded control of the premises to their contractors. They do not control these contractors. The mere existence of the asbestos on the premises is not a latent defect. It's not hazardous unless it's improperly worked with.
What does the record tell us as to what the landowner knew about the existence of the asbestos in the air?
It tells us nothing, Your Honor, other than there is a comment in Judge Babiar's opinion that mentions clouds of asbestos dust, which was lifted from the plaintiff's answering brief, which contained that statement without any citation to the record.
Let's assume that there were clouds of asbestos dust. Would you agree that within the meaning of Section 343, that constitutes a condition on the land?
I'm sorry, that constitutes a what?
A condition on the land within the meaning of 343.
No.
Why not?
Because first of all, these clouds of asbestos dust would only have arisen after the landowner had ceded control of the land to the contractor doing the work. So when my client sends the contractor in, he cedes control to that contractor. Nothing is going on until that contractor starts the work. It's only when that contractor works improperly that clouds of asbestos dust may be created. But remember, we hired skilled, knowledgeable contractors. Nobody disputes that. Who, if they performed their work properly, would not have created those clouds of dust. So it's not a condition upon the land. Not that the landowner should be responsible for. To hold the landowner responsible would then require that the landowner monitor every single contractor that he ever brings on his land, every single subcontractor, and pay attention to what hazard each and every one of them may be creating.
What, in your view, would constitute a latent defect on the land within the meaning of Section 343 of the restatement?
Well, Your Honor, the case that the plaintiffs rely upon, Hand versus Romuno, the contractor comes on to do work and he tears into the ceiling only to find that there are some beams in the ceiling that have not been properly secured to the rafters. The landowner knew nothing about it, so he wasn't held responsible because it was a hidden latent defect that even the landowner had no knowledge of. But that's a hidden defect. I mean, another example is Justice Berger, the last time I was here, talked about a hole. You know, you have a hole that you cannot see, or a hole that's improperly covered. That's a latent defect. But this is not the situation. This asbestos is not a latent defect, Your Honor. This is we have hired these people to do the work. It'd be like hiring somebody to dig the hole, and then they dig the hole improperly. We hired the people to do the work properly. We have a right to expect that. I mean, from time immemorial, the law has been that a landowner has been allowed to hire an independent contractor to do work. The mere fact that the work might involve some hazard...
Well, how do you distinguish conceptually between the asbestos that's present on the land and the hole that's been dug in the ground but not properly covered?
because the hole is not properly covered, Your Honor, is hazardous in and of itself. The asbestos sitting there is not hazardous. It's not hazardous until it's worked with improperly. So if you have a hole, suppose you have a hole that has been dug and that is properly barricaded off, but then somebody comes in and removes the barricade. Now you have done something to make that hole hazardous, whereas it was not before. The same with the asbestos. The asbestos, undisturbed, is not hazardous. It's not until it's improperly disturbed that it becomes hazardous.
So I suppose your position would be that if there were some sticks of dynamite on the land, that wouldn't be hazardous unless somebody works with it improperly.
Yeah, that's right, Your Honor. Keeping in mind, Your Honor, that I've hired somebody to come in and handle that dynamite, I have a right to expect that they will do so properly. Therein lies the point, and therein lies the distinction. You know, I have a right to hire a contractor that will come in and do the work properly. That has always been the law of the state of Delaware. That's always been the common law. And until I control that contractor and actually direct him to do something that he might not otherwise have done, I have no obligation. That is, place an obligation on me is to create a situation of vicarious liability.
Shouldn't there be some sort of a distinction drawn between the kind of hazardous situation, such as a hole in the ground, or open electrical wires, where a person of common intelligence would say to themselves, oh, there's a dangerous situation, there's a hole in the ground, I don't want to step over the edge and fall into the hole, or there are some exposed wires, I know electricity is dangerous, I would be foolish to go over there with my hand and touch the wires to see if they're live or not. Whereas when you're talking about asbestos dust in the air, no person other than the people who are actually working with the asbestos or the landowner, nobody else in that room or in that building has any reason to know that they're in a hazardous environment, do they?
Well, it depends on what you look at, Your Honor. If you look at the plaintiff's own expert, Dr. Castleman, has said all of these contractors, all of these unions that were involved in any manner with the asbestos industry were on notice of the hazards of asbestos. That's his statement. That's in and that's set forth in.
You're talking about people who work in the asbestos industry were on notice.
Yes.
What about the painter who's happens to have the misfortune of painting the walls next to where someone else is creating asbestos dust?
Well, again, the dust, it does not get created unless worked with improperly.
No, but I'm asking, how does that other tradesperson have any reason to know that he or she is in jeopardy because they're breathing asbestos dust?
Well, they have no reason to know unless warned. And then the question becomes, who is in the best position to warn? And it's the landowner's position, Your Honor, that it's the person that is in charge of the work, that is actually doing the work, that may or may not be creating the hazard, who has the best opportunity to warn. He's the one that knows what he's doing. He's the one that knows what hazards he's creating. He's the one that's actually on the job site day in, day out, moment by moment, that knows who else might be coming in contact with his work. It's like the electrician working on the junction box. He might have all sorts of wires draping down from the ceiling. He might have some live circuits someplace and dead circuits other places. He's the one that ought to warn the other contractors or contractor employees on the premises as to what is live or isn't live, what to stay away from. The asbestos contractor working with the asbestos is the one that is best able to do everything that Mr. Lilly talked about. Barricade off the site, drape it, wet it down, wrap it. It is bad tort law to split the duty to warn away from the person conducting the hazardous activity. That's simply not the way the tort law is operated.
Well, Mr. Phillips, help me out in understanding why the trial judge was wrong when he said, after addressing the comments to Section 343, that they confirm this court, meaning, I guess, himself, conclusion that Section 343 liability rests on knowledge and not control.
Well, because, Your Honor, there are a couple points to be raised. First of all, because he overlooked this court's holding in Furyk. And as we discussed the last time, Furyk...
Well, he didn't overlook it. He discusses it.
Yes. He discusses it, but he did not...
He just overlooked your view of Furyk and how it applies here.
Well, he did not discuss the control aspect of this court's Furyk decision. And clearly, this court in Furyk was addressing Section 344, which was noted to be the commercial equivalent of Section 343. Clearly, this court held that there was a control element. If you look at the Furyk decision, the Furyk court said that there was a possible basis for recovery under 383. There was foreseeability to be taken into account. But yet, even after making those findings, it went on to specifically discuss control and the various elements of control and concluded various indicia of control and concluded that there was a jury question as to whether or not the university's activities constituted control over that activity. Clearly, what this court has done in the past, as it said in Sammons versus Smith, this court's obligation is to try to harmonize the restatement of torts with the Delaware common law. The restatement of torts does not carry the force and effect of law, and the Delaware common law has always been that a landowner is not vicariously liable for its independent contractor. Judge Babiars simply chose to ignore the common law, simply chose to ignore the holding in Furyk that required control. Control is not actually or explicitly set forth under Section 344, but this court, in harmonizing Section 344 with existing Delaware common law, found that control was an element. This court should do the same thing with Section 343. As I said to you the last time, without overturning Furyk, I don't know how you could avoid doing that. Because clearly the court held that control was an element in Furyk. And Judge Babiars, for whatever reason, ignored that, didn't focus on it. But clearly, if you look at his discussion of Furyk, he did not focus on that or grasp that part of the decision.
Let me follow up on the knowledge aspect. Is it your view that if the landlord knew of the asbestos in the air risk, knew that the painting contractor was oblivious, is the landowner then under a duty to warn the painting contractor of the asbestos risk?
Well, Your Honor,
it's not a matter of, I agree that the asbestos contractor is in a better position, but just because the asbestos contractor is in a better position doesn't necessarily mean that the owner is exonerated from any other obligation.
That may be true, Your Honor. If the condition, is ongoing to the point where the landowner may be on notice and is discernible by the landowner as a hazard, but just like the painter, the landowner doesn't have an obligation to go out and discover what else everybody's doing at whatever particular time they're doing it. This, as I say, when...
But that's not the question. The question is, what if the landowner already knows that that there is going to be dust out there, asbestos dust, and that it's dangerous, and that there will be painters exposed to it? In those circumstances, does the landowner have a duty to warn under Section 343?
And I suggest to this court that it does not.
And why not?
But the existing Delaware law is that knowledge alone is not sufficient. The lower court has always held, starting with the Farrell versus ACNS in 1988, Judge Taylor wrote that
under 343?
Under any circumstance. Held that knowledge alone was not sufficient, that the an independent asbestos contractor creating a hazard without control is not sufficient to trigger liability. That was followed by a number of other cases, Katowski, Farrell, and Lukowski.
But if the asbestos is in the ground or on the site, and for whatever reason, because of atmospheric conditions, dust gets kicked up into the air, regardless of what contractors may or may not be doing, if the landowner knows that, and if, you know, an employee of a contractor is going to come into contact with that situation, would there not be a duty to warn?
Well, Justice Jacobs, first of all, that's not the situation we have here. That's,
I know that,
yeah, not the allegation being made.
We're being asked to change, basically insert a new term into Section 343 of the restatement, and I'm trying to test where you think that would come out.
Your Honor, my view is that in the absence of control over the persons creating the hazard, the landowner ought not to be burdened with the liability. Because keep in mind that this situation, although this issue arises in the context of asbestos litigation, it is going to be binding on all aspects of the contract work. So it's going to apply not only to industrial landowners, it's going to apply to commercial landowners, large and small, it's going to apply to individual homeowners. So you cannot, you ought not, in my view, create a view of the law or a ruling of law that says that these landowners are, no matter what, obliged to know what a particular contractor is doing, what hazard a particular contractor is creating, and who is at risk from those hazards. Those contractors are the ones that know what hazards they're creating. Those contractors know who is at risk from those hazards. Those contractors are best able to issue warnings.
If you're trying to save the rest of your time?
I do, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good afternoon. This is Albert Namwine. I'm from Pepper Hamilton. I represent the defendant appellee, Honeywell International. Although Honeywell is an appellee, its position is aligned, and we were awarded summary judgment by the trial court, our position and our arguments are more properly aligned with the defendant appellants. The appeals to Honeywell involves the plaintiffs Biddle and Woolian. Both Mr. Woolian and Mr. Biddle were pipe fitters who worked for approximately a few months in 1967 and 1973 at Honeywell's Claymont facility. Both Mr. Biddle and Mr. Woolian were exposed to asbestos directly in the course of performing their pipe fitting work. In particular, they were exposed to gaskets and pipe covering asbestos block cement. I think it's important in analyzing the issue before this court just to, for a moment, to step backwards and figure out how we got here. The last asbestos case to come before this court was Rocha. And in Rocha, this court refused to extend liability of a landowner to an independent contractor's employee under Chapter 15 of the Restatement Second Torts, that being the peculiar risk doctrine. And in that decision, this court found that the intent of that restatement section, the peculiar risk doctrine, was not to extend liability, it was that an other did not include an independent contractor's employee. that a person who worked with the asbestos itself was not an other, that the section was more concerned with protecting bystanders and other third parties. Plaintiffs below have not fared well under a case called Delaware's longstanding rule set forth in Sini and its progeny and followed by this court in Merson. And that rule is that a landowner is not liable to an independent contractor's employee for defective conditions or dangers inherent in performance of that contracted work unless the landowner exercises active control over their manner and methods of that work. The plaintiffs have not fared well at the trial court under this rule. And here they come today before this court, and they say, let's put aside the peculiar risk doctrine, and let's put aside Sini and its active control exception, and let's recast the same set of facts and restyle them under another theory, Delaware's safe workplace doctrine. Now this doctrine, my colleague expressed, has its roots in latent, pre-existing defect cases. That if there's a defect on the property, you invite a business invitee, you have a duty as a landowner to warn that business invitee of defects you know or should have known in the exercise of reasonable diligence. Now the safe workplace doctrine was extended in the case Diassi and Furyk to social hosts and fraternity liability, and the obligation there was that landowners have an obligation to control the activities of third parties. But this court has never extended the safe workplace doctrine when the business invitee itself creates the condition. And the reason it has never done that is because of Sini and its progeny. And Sini says that when the landowner, that you as a landowner, when you hire a contractor, you're entitled, you're hiring that person in reliance on their expertise in the materials and the handling and the work. And there's a presumption in the law that you're entitled to rely on their expertise.
But doesn't that go to the independent contractor's knowledge, which is the difference between your client's position and Mr. Phillips' client's position?
The issue of knowledge under Sini and its progeny and the active control exception never arises.
But isn't
knowledge is only...
Isn't control really a placeholder for knowledge, because control is relatively easy to prove as opposed to inquiring into knowledge, but isn't the real focus here on what was known, who knew it?
There's a presumption in the law when you hire an independent contractor. That's the whole basis of Sini and what this court followed in Merson, is that you're entitled to rely on that expertise, that the contractor who you hire to do that work has greater knowledge than you. And the law allows you to rely on that expertise in doing that work. And it's only when you take that back from the contractor and you tell that contractor how to do his or her job does the law reimpose that duty upon you. But we don't get back into, and I think it's important to keep in mind in evaluating here, that we're not just fashioning a rule for huge companies with industrial hygiene departments. This rule is going to apply to a residential consumer who goes out, for example, and hires an independent contractor to renovate their bathroom. And they hire a plumber and they hire an electrician. Now, is that individual residential consumer supposed to stick their head into what the electrician and the plumber are doing and figure out each one of their jobs and warn them about their respective duties? Or is the contractor themselves, the electrician and the plumber, who are working there, really in the best position and the most knowledgeable and presumably competent to do their jobs and to warn the other, not only their own employees, but those in the nearby vicinity?
Mr. Manwaring, let me ask you just a very basic factual question. In these cases, was the asbestos brought onto the premises or the property by the contractors, or was it being removed from the property by the contractors, or both?
In the cases of Woolian and Biddle, they actually brought the materials on as laborers and pipe fitters creating the defect. In other cases, but the analysis doesn't change.
In other cases, what?
In other cases, the analysis is, I mean, it, let's say it's a case where the independent contractor is hired to do remediation work on the premises.
Well, I think Justice Jacobs' question is, what other facts in this case are different than the two you mentioned who brought the asbestos on the premises themselves?
I'm not sure whether the other cases that I'm not involved in, whether they're all contractor created or whether we're talking about a situation where the contractor is on the premises to remediate an asbestos problem. In most of the
cases,
to remove it. But the analysis is the same. The remediation contractor would presumably have an expertise in remediation, and that therefore they should be aware of the hazards associated with asbestos remediation. I think another thing, we've mentioned one of the policies really underlying the application of CINI and its progeny, not only to the individual independent contractor employees, but to those other employees in the nearby vicinity. And another policy that this court recognized in ROCA for that proposition of not extending liability under the peculiar risk doctrine to independent contractors' employees was workers' compensation. And in this case, regardless of whether the independent contractor plaintiff created the defect or whether it's an adjacent independent contractor who's bringing the suit, in both of those instances, the person is going to be injured on the job and they're going to have available to them no-fault workers' comp insurance. And so one of the additional rationales is, why should we have the landowner pay twice? Once in the premise liability suit, and then initially the landowner pays when they're paying for the independent contractor to do the work, because a component of the contract price is an amount for workers' comp insurance. Well, these policies are fully applicable here. They're fully applicable here, and they haven't changed since ROCA.
This is in the record, that the contract price included the cost of comp?
It's trade usage. It's not something that we really, you know, the
record
doesn't
develop. Just assume that if you're paying the bill for the contractor, it'll include all the contractor's costs.
It's part of the, exactly. Your Honor.
Let me follow up on the earlier question on dynamite, see if I understand your position, which I understand it to be that if you have dynamite on your property and you hire a competent contractor to remove the dynamite, and then you have other contractors doing other things, from the landowner's point of view, the dynamite removal is a non-event, because you don't have to tell these other contractors, because if there's something any other contractor should know, it's the dynamite removal person that should let them know that, because once you've hired a competent person to do it, you just assume everything's going to be done.
And that is absolutely true. Unless asbestos, dealing with or using asbestos was an ultra hazardous activity. And my understanding of the case law here in Delaware is that Delaware has held that is not an abnormally dangerous activity. So there's no strict liability. And so accordingly, asbestos and the use of it in and of itself isn't something that's unavoidably unsafe and not necessary to impose, which essentially they're saying there's some sort of product liability for failure to warn. And it can be handled safely. And therefore, CINI, its progeny, and Merson all stand for the proposition that there's a presumption that contractor and their expertise, that they can safely handle the dynamite. Now, I don't know if dynamite is an ultra-hazardous activity or not.
Right. I mean, putting aside whether it is, but my question was, if you hired a contractor to do it correctly, from the landowner's perspective, then it's a non-event with regard to everybody else you have doing other things.
It's a non-event as to the other independent contractor.
No duty to warn.
No duty to warn. In fact, if you impose a duty to warn in these circumstances, after finding that it's within CINI, that it's part of the work you hired the contractor for, but the landowner didn't step in and take over the job, and you revert back to CINI, you're going to eviscerate that entire rule. 30 years of precedent in this court is going to be overruled and tossed out. Plaintiffs and contractor-created defect situations are merely going to assert a claim under the Safe Workplace Doctrine. That entire line of cases will no longer be the law in Delaware.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Edward Lilly. I do want to thank the court for granting permission for me to argue in this case for the plaintiffs. This case involves Restatement Section 343. And it's simple. It says that if you're a premises owner and you know of a defect or a latent defect upon the property, and you're having invitees in the property, that you have a duty to warn them or to remediate the hazard.
Now, tell us why this is a latent defect.
Well, it's a latent defect because DuPont and Pratt had these jobs done. DuPont stipulated that they would use asbestos in these jobs. They went so far as to, and when I say DuPont, I'm talking about the defendants generally, they stipulated about the thickness of the insulation, what type would be used. So they were in charge of getting, of having the asbestos on the property.
That doesn't make the asbestos a latent defect, does it?
Yes, Your Honor. Dust in the air with the use of asbestos is inevitable. It cannot be used around other people without dust escaping and going into the air. The dust, by its very nature, appears benign. It doesn't itch, doesn't make you sneeze or cough. In fact, any ramifications from the exposure take place decades later, 20, 30, 40 years. So while you're in this harmless dust, you're getting ill.
It's inevitable. The dust is inevitable only when someone is working with that asbestos material.
But the defendants in this case required that,
correct,
that it be done. Yes, Your Honor. So DuPont invited the work to be done. It invited it required the use of asbestos. It knew that the use of asbestos inevitably caused dust in the air. DuPont knew that dust was in the air.
So you're telling us that there's no way you could use asbestos safely. It's impossible. If you hired the best contractor in the world to install it, there's no way they could do it safely.
When I was here last, I was asked a question by the court as far as what, if anything, DuPont could have done, you know, about this. And I said, well, maybe they could have. I have no expertise with this answer, but perhaps they could have. They were scheduling the workers, and when they came, perhaps you could separate the trays from the insulators that are using the product. Perhaps you could do various things, maybe wall it off. But other than that, under these circumstances in these times, there was no way to safely use the products. In fact, in these same times, the insulators, who we all assume knew everything about everything, were working with this insulation without respirators. It was a harmless dust in those days. It didn't itch, it didn't make you cough, and it really didn't make you sick, except for...
Now I'm very confused. Either DuPont, under your theory, knew there was harm that would come from exposure to asbestos dust, or everyone thought it was benign and nobody thought it was going to be any problem.
The evidence,
and that's why they had no reason to believe that exposure by painters to asbestos dust caused by insulators would ever be a problem to anyone. Now, how does somebody have knowledge and a duty to warn if the knowledge wouldn't encompass a danger?
The evidence in this case before the trial court, Your Honor, was that DuPont knew all of those things. that DuPont was an expert when it came to asbestos and insulation products. And the evidence in this case is that none of the plaintiffs before you knew of that.
When you say DuPont knew that asbestos gets into the air and that that causes disease?
Yes, Your Honor. DuPont knew that that respirators should be used.
Whoever refined this in the record?
I believe it's in the statement of facts on the, it's certainly in our brief here before you, and certainly I believe in the statement of facts in the response to the motion for summary judgment.
By that you mean the place